So what I'm going to talk about today is understanding the impact of determinants, a case for data. A little background on my section. The Health Disparities Reduction and Minority Health section was originally established by executive order of the governor in 1988. And at that time, the focus was and still continues to be eliminating health disparities among the racial and ethnic minority populations in the state of Michigan. You'll see that the populations that were listed in the executive order includes Arab and Chaldean ancestry, which is unusual. In most places across this country, they are not considered a racial and ethnic minority population, but in Michigan, they are added as one of the racial and ethnic population groups that we serve. In 2007, the late Senator Michael Murphy led an effort to enact Public Act 653, which we call our Minority Health Act. It is an addition to the Michigan Public Health Code, which was established in 1985. And as an addition to that, we now have a minority health law in the state of Michigan, which it compels the state of Michigan to establish a structure to eliminate racial and ethnic health disparities. In 2010, our office published the Michigan Health Equity Roadmap, which has five priority recommendations. And I'll talk about specifically one of those recommendations today, which is to improve the collection of data, to include improved data systems and accessibility for racial and ethnic minority populations in Michigan. A little while after we published our roadmap, about a year later, the Health and Human Services National Partnership for Action was published, and that also has a major goal around data accessibility. So these two efforts are working in conjunction with one another. Just a little terminology that I will be discussing throughout this presentation, and I always like to at least put the slide up so people will have some consistency in terms of what I'm talking about when I talk about health equity, health disparities, and health inequity. Just a little idea of what the Michigan population looks like. We are about 9.9 million in total. The largest racial ethnic minority group in the state is African American at about 15%. Native American, extremely small in our state. And Asian American, about 3%, and Hispanic, 3%. For the Arab population, because during our data collection in our state, they're counted with the white population, we have been able to get some estimates. And when we pull them out, they make up about 5% of the population. So we have one of the largest populations of Arab and Chaldean populations anywhere in the country. So the reason we started our projects is because, as I stated previously, there are challenges with having good data on racial and ethnic populations. And because one of our primary recommendations is that we do improve the availability, the quality, and the accessibility of data, we decided to embark on two efforts. The issues around the availability of data often is that many of the racial and ethnic groups, American Indian and Asian populations, are very small, particularly in our state. And so it's difficult to obtain a large enough sample size through our traditional data sources, the behavior risk factor survey and the like. The other problem is that these populations can often be defined differently. And so with Arab and Chaldean being counted in the majority white population, the availability of data is pretty difficult. And then the quality. The quality is an issue as well, in that there's significant misclassification, and Mildred just talked about that, because what we get with death and birth is, particularly with death, we have more the morgue or the morticians or whoever's doing the data counting are just making a determination on what the race is without any real information. And then lastly, we don't have consistent data collection methods, and we haven't in our state. And so in order to measure equity and health disparities, we had to look at some different methods to do that. And so in our section, with the help of some other folks in our department, we decided to develop what we call the Michigan Health Equity Data Project. The purpose of that project was obviously to make data more accessible, as I had said, but to also include not just your normal what are the death rates and what are the illness rates, but to try to get some context to the data. So we also included in this data set social determinants of health indicators. We hope that this will provide some standardization, would help us measure health disparities, and also would be allow us to measure disparities over time. So what this data set contains are measures on social determinants. It also includes measures on health status, behaviors, and health care, and measures on disease status. We look at the six major populations, which includes the white reference population. We look at it over time periods, and we also look at it over using some of the standard data sources. So all of the data that we use are secondary. There are no primary data collected for this particular one. What I talk about next will be a discussion of some of the primary data collections that we're doing, but this one really includes all secondary data. There are two ways in which we look at these data. One is we look at them in terms of what we call pairwise. And what we do is we measure the difference, the disparities between a minority population of interest and between the reference population. And as I mentioned, that we use the white population in our state because that's the overwhelming majority population as the reference population. And we do that in a number of ways. Either we look at it as just a difference between percentages, or we look at it as a difference between ratios. And we look at that over time. And the second way that we analyze these data is we look at the overall disparity across all the racial and ethnic populations in relation to a statewide average. And here, the next few slides that I'm going to show you will just show you how we put these in data tables and talk a little bit about what we found over time. So this first one looks at data from 2006 to 2008. And the next time period is 2011, and that should be 2014. And what we found is that the difference, the percentage difference and the ratio difference for African-American dropout rate compared to a reference population, we saw that in time one, it was 17.5% higher, yet in time two, it was 9.8% higher. And so we look at that as a change in equity over time at 10% reduction, which gets a positive. But yet with the unemployment rate, you will notice that over the periods of time, the equity comparison worsened. And so that's one of the ways in which, and for the other indicators as well. That's one of the ways in which we're measuring equity in our state. Again, this is by no means a comprehensive way to do it, but it provides us another aspect with which we can look at data and analyze data. This particular table shows where we have taken the same information and we did it across all the racial ethnic populations for which we had data available. And you'll notice in terms of high school dropout rates, there's a improvement for African Americans, yet there's a worsening of the situation for American Indians and Asian Americans during this time period, and then an improvement for in relation to Hispanic Michiganders, I should say. And it goes on through, and we use this with all of the indicators that we have in this data set. We will do tables that show the changes over time. This is a different way in which we look at the data that I mentioned earlier, which is to take a state average, which is the vertical line going, the horizontal line going across, and we measure or we compare the rates for each of the racial ethnic populations to that state average. And you'll see where it comes to all-cause mortality, you have some semblance of equity, even though for African Americans and American Indians, they are above the line. And for gonorrhea rates for African Americans, you have lots of inequity there, or disparity, I should say. And another way in which we look at it is now this this chart from 2000 to 2009 takes the measures for all racial ethnic minority populations and looks at them in reference to the majority population. So those indicators above the line indicate that equity is improving, and those measures below the line indicate that equity for those measures is worsening. And again, these are not fully comprehensive. It just gives us another way to analyze the data, but also to look for other data sources that will complement that and give us a richer analysis. On to the second project, or projects, group of projects that we've done. We have decided, because the state of Michigan, and for those of you who are familiar with the behavioral risk factor survey that's done in most states, in all states, every year, what we have found, though, is that in our state, we never get enough data on the smaller racial ethnic populations in order to do any real analysis of what's going on with health status as related to the behavioral risk factor survey. So most people, I think, are familiar with the survey. The behavior risk factor survey for us is a collaborative effort of our department, Michigan State University, who does the research. And what we do, what the behavior risk factor survey includes, is an annual telephone survey. Data are collected among Michigan adults on risk behaviors and chronic conditions. It provides us with yearly data, but it's often hard to look at small minority groups, such as Hispanics, since the sample size is too small. And so what we have had to do over the time is to bring several years of data together to put them in any kind of analysis. And then the participants of the behavioral risk factor survey who identified as Asian or Hispanic were combined over multiple years in order to get any kind of good information. So what we decided to do as an attempt to assess, what we decided to do was develop the Minority Health Behavior Risk Factor Survey. So our section decided to put funding into conducting behavior risk factor surveys for the smaller populations so that we can get annual or more regular and more consistent data. And so what we did was we followed the protocol for the CDC Behavior Risk Factor Survey with a few changes. One of those is that we decided for every Behavioral Risk Factor Survey we were going to do, we included Dr. Kamara Jones's Reactions to Race module. And we thought that was important because we are doing Behavioral Risk Factor Surveys for minority populations, and we wanted to know the degree to which race plays a role in health. And so intentionally we include that module on all that we do. And in fact, our section has paid for that module to be included in the statewide behavior risk factor survey as well. And what it also allows us to do is increase a number of topics that are germane to those particular racial and ethnic populations. So, and we're also able to look at data by subpopulations because now we get a big enough sample when we do a special behavior risk factor survey. So we can subdivide by gender, by age, and other characteristics, education and household income, and begin to make some assumptions or some analyses around what's going on with these smaller populations. So in addition to changing this a little bit, because I was going to say one other thing that we do differently when we do the minority health behavior risk factor surveys is CDC waits until the end to ask for race and ethnicity. That's the way the protocol is. We do not do that. We ask for race and ethnicity up front. And one of the ways it allows us to initially screen out people who we aren't going to interview, and it saves us tons of money, which we don't have tons of money. So it really is a great tool that we use. So we flipped it just a little bit in order to make it work for us. But in addition to being able to collect this information, what we also have changed as we've moved through this process is we don't do the typical paid survey research to do the questions, and then they give us the data, and then we write a report. This has also made us look at a different kind of equity in terms of an inclusive process. So for the first time, we did the Arab and Chaldean behavior risk factor survey a couple years ago, we actually assembled a team that included some academics, some folks who are serving Arab serving organizations, and a team of folks who now were involved in the entire process, from looking at the questions or adding modules to getting the word out to the community that this is an okay survey and that when you get a call, you should participate. And we also include that group in analyzing the data. It has given us a much richer experience in getting the perspective of what these data mean when they come back, and it also has helped us in writing the final reports. So this has been a great process for us, and what we have a few of the reports already published, and we found some things out. So from the 2012 Hispanic BRFS, this is the first comprehensive behavioral risk factor survey done for Hispanics in our state. And then we actually repeated this in 2015. So we're starting to get more consistent data. But this is what we found. These are some of the things that we found in that particular, in the results of that survey. For the Arab BRFS, again, these are some of the highlights from that. And we're repeating the Arab BRFS this year. And then we did an Asian and Pacific Islander BRFS in 2012. The interesting thing there is that what we found was, just like in the general BRFS, when we looked at, because Asians are such a small group and because there's so many subpopulations, what we got by doing the regular BRFS, what we got by doing the BRFS, is we didn't get a significant difference in results than the state got. So the question for us was, do we continue to do it, or do we try to find another way to tease out what disparities are happening in those populations? And so for the first time, we actually did not do a BRFS. What we decided was, we looked at are you trying to get rid of me? We looked at a research project that had been done in Minnesota, and what they chose to do was look at birth certificates and birth data for Asian subpopulations. And so we repeated that analysis, and we will be producing that report very shortly. But very interestingly, we finally were able to start to look at the differences in the subpopulations, because and there are significant differences. And so this will give us much better data than doing the BRFS. So another thing is that if we need to change the method, we do that in order to get really good data on these populations. And so in conclusion, Mildred, we have found that improved data collection analysis are vital to minority health. It's vital to a minority health program. Otherwise, you're just sort of shooting in the dark. Secondly, the Health Equity Data Project, which tries to monitor equity over time for specific populations, helps us evaluate our progress that we're making or lack thereof. And then the Minority Health BRFS provides critical data that were not previously available. And so the collaboration part of this process has really given us great insight on how to go about getting not just more data, but to get better, more accurate data on these populations. Thank you.
Yes, I'd like to thank all of the speakers for this session. And as I mentioned, as I introduced the session, that this was all planned because this is the 30th anniversary of the Heckler Report. And in that report, I mentioned to you in terms of what the concerns were around the Heckler Report and what the recommendation, and that included establishment of the Office of Minority Health. And some states in this region took a proactive role because they attended the release of the Heckler Report. So you have the states in this region who took a very proactive role. In Ohio, where State Senator Ray Miller went back and called Governor Celeste and said to him, this is what we need to do. In Indiana, Dr. Woody Myers went back, and the establishment of the Task Force on Black and Minority Health, which was still in existence. When we talk about the federal government, oftentimes sustainability, these are examples, just a few examples, of the sustainability of what has happened from the Heckler Report until now. I'm going to open it up for questions, but during the question and answer period, I have invited some individuals who were part of the initial establishment and were staff in the Office of Minority Health. And because next year is the 30th anniversary of the Office of Minority Health, but there will also be 30th anniversary of state offices of minority health, and Ohio has taken a proactive role in establishing local offices of minority health. So I'm going to just do a few, entertain a few questions, and then I'm going to ask, because the purpose of this session, and it was to really have an interactive discussion, because as I said in another session, I've read the report during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt era in the report of the Social Security Administration where they said we need to do something. The federal government needed to address the health issue of people in this country, meaning the Negro and the American Indian. So there were things put in place. Then I knew about the Heckler Report. Well, when I'm 300 years old and attending the American Public Health Association, I don't want to hear those sessions in terms of we are still trying to address health disparities. We want to talk about the historical perspective of what we are living now, but that we are, that there are no more health disparities. So that's why I have a goal of 300. I have relatives who are 100 plus. So I have to live more than them, longer than them, yeah. So with that, I want to entertain the, do you have any questions? Yes. And you know what? And I always say this should be a used opportunity for networking. So as you ask your question, I'd appreciate if you identify who you are and where you're from.
Ed Marshall, Indiana University. Bill, this is probably for you and maybe for Cheryl. I like the idea of the health data surveillance. Build it, is it possible? How this may already happen. But if we can find the unit kind of maybe make it such that all the states that we can find can have a similar sort of report that we can analyze all over time, the pluses and the minuses as it relates to certain morbidities that tend to affect minorities within those states?
Yeah, now I've always used, since I had offices of minority health in all of my states, I always use them as my advisory council. So I'll have to ask my advisory council if this is something that they would want to do.
Well, I would suspect that through your data,
data work group.
That's probably something that should be brought up.
Yes, yeah, so that will be a follow-up action item. And I, you know, and then I'll add you as an advisor since you're retired, so that'll help you as well. Always leaving you as an expertise. Yes.
However, in this country, it serves a real purpose.
You want to use the mic?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All the way in the back? Yeah, okay. Only reason I asked, I was chair of the EHOP committee, so those were concerns.
Okay. I know Time Magazine did an article, I want to say maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and about how you guys stay with the going forward, what the average minority looks like. And so, in essence, I understand what you're saying. There's probably more and more a mixture of different races and things. So by then, you will see more people who are multiracial, you know, because, again, the challenge would be, again, a former epidemiologist would be, how are you going to count them? Because you can't segment people, some of them force, or different things like that. And so when you're doing 2 or more races or 3 or more races or different things like that, how are you going to continue to define what's going on with specific groups? I think that's what's going to be the challenge moving forward. And I don't know how, I hope that everyone's still around 40, 50 years, you know. I'm not going to live 300 years, like, you know that I don't believe. But I think it's going to continue to grow. It's going to continue, and you're going to see more multiracial. So I think now what we have to figure out is how we're going to report it. Specifically, too, the different sections of groups want to know what's happening within their area. Take Native or American Indians. I know that's been a challenge in Indiana for years in regards to when we're reporting, maybe in the first thing where it's just one race, but they're counting, well, there's more people. So it may say there's 19,000 American Indians, and that's what we count when we're looking at different reports and things, but then they're counting 42,000 that says, I'm American Indian. So I think that would be the challenge.
Okay. There's a question in the back. Yes.
Yes.
In regards to the challenges, there's some people in regards to reporting different things that just feel like it's because it's a one-touch thing in most cases, and so if there's no follow-up implemented or different things like that, you're just touching the person. Are you really making a lasting impact that's going to make a difference in moving forward? So I think that's what some arguments are in regards to healthcare, as far as the challenges. Challenges that we face is a lot of different challenges of the report. So I think you need to have support from the top if you're going to do a big lasting event, especially the Valley Health Department. We have that, thankfully. And then again, engaging those sponsors, the community partners. We work with Indiana Blood Expo, and so sometimes challenges in regards to, say for this year, they moved where we had been traditionally, the health fair. And so the health fair was further back. And so if you have a population, there's very people that come, but say senior night, all those people have to walk like a very long distance to that, it can be challenging. So sometimes you have to kind of roll the punches because you never know what's going to happen. Inclement weather, if it rains, people are not going to come out, you know, or different things. If you have a concert or an Oprah's having a session, I'm gonna lose. You know, I'm gonna lose in that fact. But we've been fortunate to where the health fair is one of the premier things at the Indiana Blood Expo that people come to take advantage of. And so we're grateful for that. But that's, you know, challenges, just like any program, you have people that are resistant, you have people that are on board, you have bureaucracy of getting things, contracts, and all that other stuff. So those are some of those wonderful challenges that people don't get to see. They just get to see the, oh, ooh, come in the room, different things like that. What are you going to do this year? Are you going to be able to have the services? Are you going to be able to make sure that you're covering everybody? Are you going to be able to have the money to make sure you're covering everything, the budget, those different things?
Here's a question here.
Hi, just a couple of questions. I was,
your name?
Annette Johnson, New York State Department of Health, Office of Minority Health. Question to Jones about the Cincinnati.
Yes.
You talked about being able to follow up. Some people allow nurses to come to the home, others to provide literature. If you ever look at a comparison to see what happens with, in terms of, you probably have a comparison in terms of outcome, in terms of people actually following up with their children, those who have nurses and those who don't have nurses to live.
That's what I was referring to showing us in the slide. I had three columns.
Okay.
We found 2 weeks before the visit some of the people that had nurses that had been classified as literature and were going back to sports. We haven't completed that yet. But honestly, most of them did get the nurse. According to what the nurses, they were very few who only had literature.
Okay, so all right, so as I was in a different literature, usually if I'm not going to lie in my home, and you're getting literature, I'm not doing anything much. In terms of Michigan, I'm from Michigan, so I have to in terms of, I looked at the data, we were looking at the changes over time between 2000 and 2009. With what's happened around the aisle industry in the state since 2009, would you expect what's going to be happening with the data in terms of dropout rate, employment, unemployment, all of those things from 2009 to now? Because I'm thinking it's going to go down.
Well, actually, one of the things that we saw, which is why I kept moving that these data are really providing different dimensions, but in and of themselves are not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we found was during the height of the recession, the equity between black and white actually got better, but that's because white unemployment
was up as well.
Exactly. So it doesn't give us truth. So what it's saying is the difference between these populations is changing. But are they both improving overall? So you do have to limitate to the left.
Yeah.
And so that's why we don't use it solely on its own. That's why we're doing like a risk factor and some other things. So we will have comprehensive sources of data that will give us a better analysis if you're right.
Exactly. And looking at within the Asian, Asian population, because they have subgroups. I'm in New York, and we have to start doing that same thing, looking not grouping people together, but looking at the subpopulation. So I'm hoping that the tools that you guys are using, that not only shared within your region, but get shared across the country, because I think we can all use them.
Well, Minnesota did a great job, like you said, with the maternal project, the Asian maternal project. For the first time, you're actually seeing where you can share the Vietnamese population first. And then the other challenge is that the majority of Asian population in the state is Asian Indian and then next Chinese. So for Burmese and Vietnamese and Hmong, you have to figure out, and that's what this maternal society is allowing.
So
we'll probably do that within the next few months.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because that tool was something that we used abroad. We've had a large influx of refugees from Burmese into certain areas, so we're going to use our people now.
Yeah. I have a question there and then a question here. Yes.
She sent me the 75.
Okay.
But let me say this. For the Asian BRS, that was the first foray into joining as a collaborative project. So now we're going to replicate that with expanding. So we haven't done it comprehensively
as we did with that. That was our lesson learned to move forward.
It would be interesting to hear more about that, if you do that, and how to pull the groups together and have those discussions, because I think that's not a good process, but I think it's very important.
Okay,
thank you.
You want to speak up?
Indiana University of Public Health. And I'm interested in knowing, I'm really interested in data collection and how that data collection informs policy. What's the goal in the other side of changing healthcare system structures and the implementation of the class standards in the reduction in disparities in that region of five? So it's a question for all of you. What is going on in terms of the
last standard?
The cultural competence and cultural
literacy. Oh, trust me, we know it's like. We eat, serve, love, work together. Isn't Ohio doing something in regards to class?
I was going to answer that after the two of you. Yes. No, but the two of you answer.
All right. In regards to class standards, I know that each state does something in perspective as far as how they're implementing within their systems and different things like that, whether it's offering corporate competency training, whether it's trying to do class. I know in Emerson Park, Medicaid has there recently that it is mandatory and different things. So I know in Indiana we try to do making sure that we do use cultural competency training, we are implementing class standards, try to make people aware of the importance of class standards and different things possible. But I know Ohio does.
I said I'll answer that. Okay, go ahead.
So for us, we were recently funded with the Office of Mental Health and Black project that we did was to work with community organizations across the state. So we just completed a 3-year project of doing that. And what resulted from that was we have an actual everyday class training. We've got to report to do class, but not without doing any kind of training. And so we do an everyday training that incorporates class as the way to operate and operationalize in some regard. So we're doing that throughout our department with our employees, and we work with the community organizations
throughout the state. In Ohio, what they've done is used it in several ways. One, as I mentioned earlier on the outset, is that Ohio is the only state, and I believe New York may have a city office of minority health, but Ohio has local offices of minority health and several local health departments throughout the state. And they have used that as their framework for everything that they do. The other thing that the Ohio Commission on Minority Health was able to do, along with the Office of Health Equity and the Health Department, is to insert language into contracts as well as Medicaid. In the state of Wisconsin, and I'm sorry I don't have that session number because it was a little mistake. That person was supposed to be in this panel, but they're in another panel. In the state of Wisconsin, they have fully integrated the class throughout, you know, the entire health department. So it's integrated within the state health plan, and they will begin to do training on the class standards. And so it will be integrated. So it's integrated also in contracts as well. Okay, and the question, yes. No, I'd like for you to stand up because I'd like for you to introduce yourself and something that you used to do, if you could stand up. As you formerly did.
Henry Montez is a doctor of admissions back in 1985-86. I want to say one thing about Indiana. Woodrow Myers is not a hard sell because it turns out that Dr. Lincoln and was on my I think it was on our education. And so when we talked to Wendy, it was a legal discussion about how he was going to implement minority elements.
Yes. I think, yes.
Well, he was a friend.
If you could just repeat it for those, because there are certain states that don't have offices of minority health. So this will give some perspective.
In Indiana, we had a long-standing relationship with Woodrow Myers, and so it wasn't a matter of trying to convince him, it was a matter of how he would do it. And he did it really with our support. When we got started with this this adventure, it was an adventure. It was a ground uphill battle in some sense. We had to operate within the federal system to convince people that the HECR report was a meaningful treatment of the epidemiology of disparities, although we call it all minority health. People did not understand excess deaths as a concept, but when we started to talk around the country, we were like preachers, missionaries, trying to convert a bunch of people in public health and in the community to the ideas that we held to be so critical for advancing minority health. We ran into a lot of great people. We did a lot of good things and we made a lot of mistakes. We didn't have full information. I think our investment in the states was one that we probably could have doubled our effort in and probably saw a lot more states than I think initially the 30 that we got. The other thing that affected us long term was the changes in public health, fiscal changes and organizational changes. A lot of states reorganized their public health departments, combined them with behavioral health, combined them with Medicaid, and then uncombined them. So that impacted minority health. In the states where we had good leadership, we still see the vestiges of minority health. The other thing that was interesting was the academic world. We had a number of discussions here at APHA. In fact, my first presentation in APHA was Las Vegas. And that was when we started to talk about excess deaths and everything. But we had a lot of skeptical colleagues in epidemiology and in community health who saw this as a heresy almost. So we had to convince people. And what happened over the 2 or 3 years that I was there is that we doubled and tripled and quadrupled the number of supporters. And soon, it wasn't a matter of us talking about minority health, it was everybody else talking about it. And so it was a fun period, and I think if I had to do it all over again, let me back up and say one other thing. At the same time that we were growing, Dr. Michael McGinnis was growing what is now Healthy People, whatever, 2030, 28, whatever. It was 1990 objectives. And we were in competition because I was running a similar process trying to insert this notion of minority health in the federal agencies. And of course, the interesting thing that we asked them to sort of count what they're doing. And like most of the counts of minorities, that if it had a minority statement in it somewhere, grant or a program, they kind of the whole budget, as if it was focused on minorities. So we had these outrageous numbers. But I think if I had it to do all over again, there'd be a couple of things that I'd do differently. I'd emphasize capacity development. Not at the grant process that we did. We needed to build infrastructures, not just in the states, but in communities that were grounded in a financial situation that would allow them to be sustainable. And the second thing that I would have done is that we should have nurtured the academic institutions and started minority fellowships, and Herb ultimately did that when we went to AAMC and started to push a groundbreaking effort to build more positions. And I think that's what I think we would have done differently. Build the capacity of communities to be self-sufficient and sustainable in addressing their own issues. and I think it would have mattered a whole lot more. Now, parenthetically, in 1999, a good friend of mine, Dr. Dave Prim, who just died recently, was able to build something called the Minority AIDS Initiative. The problem was the statutory language said that you shall build the capacity of minority communities to address HIV. But how it got implemented is a totally different thing. But had we done that, had we started with building structures and behaviors within those structures and within communities, I think our impact would be far reaching. And sort of the final thing I think is that the question on, what's it going to look like 20 years from now? Well, I suspect that we will be talking about a new concept of minority health. And I think that one of the clearest examples of that we've talked about over the last 10 or 15 years, social determinants, health determinants of health, that's where we're going to make the real strides. Because, see, then we'll talk about the contribution of unemployment. And we'll say, maybe what we need to achieve some of these outcomes on the health side is we need more employed people, more businesses, more community control. And maybe what we might have to go to is an old concept that we used in the early 70s to change the distribution of capacities for care by going back to a certificate of need, where we talk about certificate of need in a community context. And so we don't have the Los Angeles or Houston phenomena where we have like these hospitals that are about 60, 70 in the same area trying to serve a population that's 25 miles distant. Maybe we'll have community health centers that actually serve and stay in the community. Maybe we'll have mental health centers that don't draft and die as the community mental health center program did in most states because of the lack of community focus and emphasis and funding. So, the prospects for minority health are still very good, and I hope your offices stay around forever and a day.
Yeah. Okay, it's almost 10 o'clock, but I thought it was interesting that, and that's why I asked Warren Hewitt to come, because when I attended APHA in New Orleans, and I can't remember the year, the way most of us knew about who had not heard about the Heckler Report, how we knew about the staff in the Office of Minority Health, because we were talking about doing something social, and Warren Hewitt identified himself. He said, I am the Negro and the African American in the Office of Minority Health. He said, I'd like to introduce you to Henry Montes, who is the Hispanic in the office. And he introduced us to all of the staff in the Office of Minority Health. I had the fortune to meet Herb Nickens because I was at that time the regional coordinator for the Black Caucus of Health Workers, had a conference in Cincinnati, and as he said, Woodrow Myers and Steve, they said, Mildred, we can get you the first director of the Office of Minority Health. I say, right, tell me anything. So Herb Nickens came and made his first initial appearance outside of HHS at the region off that the conference, the Black Caucus of Health Workers Regional Conference in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I thought that was very, I teased them after that and said, well, I'll believe you the next time. I want to just thank you for coming to this, to this session, and ask that you do, and I'm just going to do a very brief summary. You heard from Dr. Camille Jones, who talked about lead, and I've done a lot of studies in lead, and that's something we need to really look at, because as we're talking about learning abilities in children, then that impacts quite a bit. When we talk about health literacy, we need to talk about it's more just comprehensive. What is the barrier to the learning? And some of that might have its genesis in, the child having a diagnosis of lead levels. We then heard from Antoinette Holt, who talked about increasing access to health care for many people who don't have health care through the Indiana Black Expo. Then we heard from Cheryl Ware, who provided a framework for measuring, you know, health disparities and health equity. And I'd like to thank them, and that we will continue to exist. And I always say the Offices of Minority Health in my region, they're either together on chewing gum and super glue and prayers and some others, but continue to exist. And so when people say that they need money, you can see that Cheryl Ware continues to exist, and she does not have any funding from the federal government. And that in Cincinnati, they are trying to, with, you know, to establish a local office of minority health, but continue and have made many impacts in terms of reducing infant mortality in the city of Cincinnati, doing things the old-fashioned way of, hey, visits in the hospital and post-discharge visits in the home. I'd encourage you to call your state office of minority health. If you don't have one, then stop by the Office of Minority Health booth, and you've met Michelle. I'd like for Alexis Vakos to stand up, because she is the director, a deputy director, not deputy director, senior advisor in the Office of Minority Health, and ask that you have a conversation with her. I'd also ask that you use the Region 5 model, which has sustained offices of minority health since the early 80s, as well as the local offices of minority health. So when you return to your cities, that you can use this transfer, this model, to your city. I'd also ask that you take the information that you learned here, and when you leave here and someone asks, where have you been, you can say, this is what I learned. I'd like to thank the Black Caucus of Health Workers for inviting this session. I'd also encourage that you, if you're a member of the APHA, to become active in your section, that to begin to think about submitting an abstract next year so that we can continue to increase the visibility of the work that's being done across the country. And in final, I'd like to say that as the, well, I'm Mildred Hunter, Chicago, Illinois. But on Wednesday, on Thursday, I will be the Region 5 coordinator for the Office of Minority Health for Region 5. And as you talked about, when we talk about closing the health gap, elimination of health disparities, that we will take care of you even though you don't live in the city of Chicago. We are cash strapped. But if you get sick or something happens, we will be forced to take care of you. I don't want to contribute to the disparities while you're here. And so you are adopted. You are an official and a visitor, because we take care of minorities and people wherever they are. And at this time, you are in the city of Chicago. And so you are adopted, and I ask that you continue to be healthy while you're here, that safe travels when you return, and continue to believe and continue to trust that we will eliminate health disparities. But we need everyone, not just health professionals, but anybody on the street. We need to have this conversation all the time. And as a take-home item, I'd ask that you repeat a similar session as we had here today in your local communities, as well as in your state public health association. So plug is, get involved in your state public health association and repeat a similar session and have a conversation about health disparities and what we are going to do about closing the health gap. I wish you well and continue to enjoy the American Public Health Association.